Hello everyone, and welcome to another Warwick Thursdays, Digital Warwick Thursdays, with me, Tim Leach, your MA convener, and also historical fiction novelist. And the thrust of what I'm going to talk about today is going to be around some of the nuts and bolts of agents and publication. That's often one of the areas obviously people have interest in, and it's often one of the areas for Warwick Thursdays that we like to prioritize in particular. Next term, agency, to sort of see the agent side point of view, because hearing what they say about the process is obviously very important. But I thought I'd share my experience and some of the advice that I would share, some of the resources that I would share with it as well, in that kind of way. So I'm going to begin by, firstly, I'll be talking about what was like my journey, which is a grandiose term to kind of getting published. Then I'll be on to some more kind of practical advice around how I would advise you to approach trying to get published, and in what way and why in that sense. So my brief biography would be around, I came and did a degree, undergraduate English and creative writing, 2004-2007. Got to the end of it, had a really good time. Well, I had a tricky time in some respects at university, but by the end of it, I really fell in love with the writing. I knew I wanted to write more. My initial point of assessment with myself at that point, I kind of took stock of where I thought I was at a writer. I'd had a very good last year. My final project had gone very well. And I just took stock of where I was at as a writer. My biggest weakness that I perceived at that point, which I think is probably a correct assumption at that point, was that I was 21 and I didn't know very much about the world. And so my feeling at that point was it was not a something that was going to be solved by more education at that point. Luckily, Father Time was going to take care of that for me in that sense. I just had to wait around and get a bit older and, you know, try and develop a lower back problem and, you know, sort of like a heightened degree of cynicism, whatever else, all the stuff that comes, worse hangovers that come with aging has been my experience so far. So I thought I'd take some time out. So I went to live in London. I wouldn't necessarily recommend, one of my key recommendations to writers is always lower your overheads, you know, and so maybe live somewhere, you know, that's still lovely and cheap, you know, which is why I'm in Sheffield, which is lovely and amazing and suits me much better. Also very cheap, which is also good, but I digress. But I was living in London, working as a copywriter, trying to get novels off the ground in the morning, came back to do the Warwick MA. I think I said the induction, it'll be good to carry this on, but, you know, I'd finished a book before I came on the Warwick MA, and my grand plan was to polish it up over the course of the MA. Looked at it when I got here, thought it was terrible and garbage, chucked it away, started something else. For my long project, which ended up becoming the first book, the first two books, in fact, in some ways. I'd gotten about 70,000 words or so drafted by the end of the MA, handed in the first 20,000 words as the long project. Then I left, went back to, you know, learn from your mistakes. I didn't, but, you know, sort of like, I sort of went back to London, but did slightly better this time. Like, initially I was being a kind of copywriter the first time I was in London full time. It was fine. It was okay. They were nice people, but it was very exhausting. It was very tiring. The only way I could get to do anything writing-wise was to get up very early in the morning and write before work, go to a coffee shop before work. I'd find I was too busted out by the end of the day, too exhausted by the commute and a day's work, pushing words around the page, mostly writing for search engines. I didn't want to do any writing in the evening. I just wanted to eat and chill out on the sofa with my flatmates and go to sleep. So I get up in the morning, get up pretty early, get to Cafe Nero, milk out an espresso con panna for as long as I possibly could. The best thing about that technique as well is also you get like stamp cards, you know, obviously, so you get your stamp cards, which means you get every 10th coffee free, which meant if I did 2 weeks, 5 days a week, so it was basically 9 days of espresso con panna and then a ludicrous caramel uber latte milkshakey thing every second Friday. And that was my reward for putting in my 2 weeks at the office before I went to put in my 2 weeks at the office. So that has benefits to it. It had something to do with structure to it. It had a sugary reward every fortnight for it as well. When I came back to London after doing the MA, I was working part-time in Waterstones, because I decided I didn't want to do full-time work. I didn't want to do an office job. I was happy to work for not very much money, to live in a very dilapidated flat that had water running down by the fuse box by the end, which was quite exciting. Lucky I'm here, you know, sort of like, and didn't die in an electrical fire. And I was working for a while afterwards. It was probably the timing process for the first book was probably about a little over a year, I would say, to get the first draft done. Probably about For the first book, anyway, for reasons that will become apparent, another year and a half or so of editing. I think it was more time editing than it was drafting, which has varied from book to book, but it's often quite close to a kind of one-to-one ratio, is my experience. I think my editing time is shrinking down, which is hopefully a good sign. I think maybe, but we'll see. But that was the kind of the way that it went. And so when it came time, so firstly, before thinking about approaching agents, the things that, because there's sometimes a tendency to put the cart before the horse, so to speak. And so there's strategies for approaching agents, but you do the things, some of the things I think I did right was to take a very honest look at myself as a writer and a very honest look at my writing as well. And one of my talents, if I have them as a writer, you know, is much more around having an assessment and understanding of my own work, which is something that I developed a lot of at the MA through the working process in that sense, having that curiosity and interest in how my work was being read and regarded by other people in that kind of way, which I think is what led to the realistic assessment that my first book, you know, that I came to the MA with was no good. You know, sort of, I could see that there were serious flaws within it that were probably solvable through editing. It is important to have that awareness and have that, which is a difficult skill to develop, about knowing when to stick and knowing when to call or when to fold or whatever else poker metaphors abound. Sometimes people fixate too strongly on one particular idea or one particular book. There can be a sunk cost fallacy that happens when people lock on and they're like, this is the one book that I must write, that I have been writing for however long, in that kind of way. Maybe it is, it might be, but maybe you are holding on too tight to a project that is actually a really good learning experience, but isn't viable, which is for a whole variety of reasons why a book isn't commercially viable. I mean, that's the other thing that we'll get onto later, is that publication is a very, particularly traditional publication, is a very specific process that is interested in certain kinds of books. You know, it is not necessarily a knock against the book. You could write something that is beautiful and true and meaningful, but if it's only realistically going to sell to 100 people, publishers will not take it on. Traditional publishers, large-scale publishers, will not take it on because it is not a viable thing for them. They will tell you that it is a beautiful, touching memoir about this particular factor, but if it isn't an ability to have that kind of appeal out there, then it won't be a goer in that sense. So do try and develop this ability to have a non-judgmental, honest look at what the book is doing, where it's at. Obviously, the reverse is also true. People often fall into the trap of abandoning projects before they get going in that sense and constantly throwing things away, you know, which was my initial problem, I think. I initially had that problem of abandoning lots of projects and never finishing them. But then once I'd finished a project, looked at it, saw it wasn't a going concern, chucked it away, I think, correctly in that sense. And I think I have had a pretty good ability to judge the nature of the projects that I'm working on as to whether or not they have potential or not, which is an acquired skill. Part of that, I think, is about developing an interest and an understanding of some of the stuff, frankly, that I was quite sniffy about when I was a student. You know, I was all beautiful sentences and big ideas when I was a student, and I kind of regarded things like plot and pacing and character change as those things, those hacks in genre fiction did. And, you know, I had to learn the hard way that if you write a book without these things, you can do it, but you've got to be much more of a genius than I am to pull it off. You know, sort of like if you are not a genius like me, but you are able to do some stuff with the bread and butter of five act structures, putting characters to interesting choices and changes, keeping an eye on managing tension and pacing throughout narratives, how you vary these kind of things. Just some of the nuts and bolts, which is often where I now direct a lot of my teaching, because I often find students are really, really strong at the level of the sentence. They just often struggle a lot more with these larger questions of kind of structure and pacing and that kind of thing. So before you leap straight into publication, before you start leaping into this is the book I'm working on, so of course I should publish this book. Maybe not. You know, it's important to be willing to take them as learning experiences as well, to be able to have that realistic assessment of how your work is doing, where it's at. So that'd be my, you know, advice sort of number one in that kind of way. But I submitted to a couple of students, one of whom I'd had come to Warwick Thursdays and we'd gotten chatting about the book. You know, it was all seemingly it was going great. She came to the anthology launch where I read out from the first chapter, and she said, "Oh, it sounds great. Yeah, please send me the first three chapters." And I did, and she turned it down off the first three chapters. But luckily, I'd also sent it to another agent at that point, who had also come to Warwick Thursdays, but I'd not seen on or been that event. But Maureen had been, and she'd thought it would be a good fit, which it was and wasn't, for reasons we'll get onto later on. And I sent, sent three chapters and a query letter to this agent. She offered full manuscript. I sent her the full manuscript. Then we went in, had a meeting. And it was a really good meeting. It was a really lovely meeting. She talked through some pretty radical changes potentially for the book, involved splitting it into two books rather than one. You know, I'd written 120,000 word first draft, ended up taking the first 80,000 words of that and turning it into a 90,000 word first novel, ended up taking the last 40,000 words of the what had been the initial first draft, turned that into another 90,000 word novel. She'd correctly identified there was a kind of degree of strong kind of compression there. And so we went through a long process, you know, a long-ish process of editing. I think it was a good, I think I'd sent her the second draft, I think. It was about, or I'd say like a draft 2.5 was what I sent on as the submission, which took me about 3 months to do, I think, from my initial first draft. It was then, I think, about another 9 months of back and forth with her doing some redraft, obviously doing this initial split, sending her draft to the first book, going away, working on it again, exploring some kind of blind alleys and that kind of thing, which was amazing. I mean, I'm going to sing the praises of my agent later on, and agents, you know, more generally later, but it was a really, really incredible learning experience and a very, very special working relationship that has kind of continued now for me in that kind of way. I'm fans of agents, or good agents, for practical concerns around access to traditional publishing. We talk about some other models kind of later on and so on and so forth. But if you find a good one and a good editor at a publishing house, the way in which they work with your work is really wonderful and really fascinating, and will push you to places that you did not think that you could go to, if they're doing their work well in that sense. So it was a big, quite dramatic edit as well. I mean, that's one thing to bear in mind. You know, it's maybe a bigger edit than an agent would take on in that sort of sense. You know, it's pretty dramatic turning one book into two books and all the rest of it. So you want to get the work as good as you think you can get it. But the agent is not necessarily looking for something that is ready to go in that way. Editors are, talk a bit more about that later on, but that's the nature of the business has gone. But often agents, if you find the right agent at the right time and they are intrigued enough in your project, they may well be willing to work with you on something for a larger scale period in that kind of sense. We think that she then, once we'd gone through this kind of like drafting process and we had the first book ready to go, she sent it out to a bunch of editors. I think it was about 8 in the first round. I think 6 of them said no. One of them said maybe, and one of them was really keen. So we went with the one that was really keen. That became a two-book deal. Those two books came out, had really good, some really nice reviews, really good reader responses. The first book had a kind of shortlisting. It didn't sell as well as the publishers wanted, and the publisher then ran into some financial trouble later on. And as a midlister, I was the one for the chop. So, you know, they didn't take on the kind of third book. Had a tough time again then finding a whole third book, Smile of the Wolf. It was quite a long process, actually. I think we went around a lot of the houses before eventually we came to my current publisher, Head of Zeus, who took it on and have just taken on another a three-book project, which is the work-in-progress thing. That's my exciting thing in the pipeline. That I've had lots of good news over the quarantine period. Essentially, it's been a good year. It's been a bumpy year for Tim and signing contracts. Essentially, but I say that as to say that, you know, it's a continuous process, not a one-off in that sense. It's not a thing where you make it and then you've made it forever in that way. I'm still fighting for every book, really. You know, that you know, so that's one thing to be aware of in the I'm more philosophical about it now, perhaps. You know, I take it as that's not a bother to me necessarily or an anxiety. I feel very lucky to have had the books out that I have out, I do write every book like it might be my last one, because it might be, in terms of like having it out there in the kind of world in that sense, which I think is, I try and think of that as a healthy mentality rather than an unhealthy mentality. You know, I think, I hope it puts the pressure on me to leave everything on the field, so to speak, with every book that I kind of write in that kind of way. But I always say this to students, that a lot of the reason I kind of say this in this kind of way, and the publishing process for me has been, it's been wonderful. It's not been a super success in terms of like sales. There's been a bit of money that's come in, which has been nice. But I have very low standards in terms of reader response, in terms of what qualifies the book as being a success to me. For me, 20 people read it, preferably 20 people I don't know and really loved it, it was worth it. You know, that's worth it. If I got to put a book out there that 20 strangers, so if I get 25 star reviews on Amazon, then, you know, for me, the book was a success. You know, that's my very low. I mean, again, that's not a success from a publishing point of view, and a publisher requires more than 20 people to buy the book and love the book in that kind of way. For me personally, that's enough. You know, that's the that's a beautiful and wonderful thing. It has led me to this career that I'm in as well at the moment, which has also been a beautiful and kind of wonderful thing. But the thing I always say to people is that the pleasures of being published don't outweigh the sufferings of writing. The pleasures of being published are lovely. Getting nice fan mail is lovely. Every so often an email pops in my inbox from someone randomly around the world who says, oh, I love this book, or someone contacts me on Twitter or whatever else. When you get that call, that you get the deal kind of come through, yes, I dance around my room and call everyone I know and get drunk and I'm very happy. But it fades, it passes, you know, sort of like it's, you know, they're passing pleasures, they're little treats along the way. And writing is a long, continuous, tough process in that way, as you will know already in that sense. And that pleasure of publication alone is not enough on its own, I don't think. You have to find a way, I think, or at least for me personally, to make the pleasures of writing outweigh the pleasures of publication. You know, I got into writing, I wanted to be published for a variety of reasons. Part of it was definitely ego and validation. I wanted to know that I could get books out there. Part of it was practical concerns of trying to make some kind of a career from it, you know, both partly partly through the writing itself, and maybe more indirectly through things like teaching in that way. You know, for most writers, I've made about, I think it's about 15 grand a book before taxes and before agent fees. Each book takes me usually at least 2 years to write, if not more. You know, you don't need to be very good at maths to realize that, unless you're willing to live very, very cheaply on a lot of baked beans, that's probably not a going concern. In that sense, most writers are having other jobs. The writing would potentially open up interesting avenues of work for me in that way. So partly there was career stuff. Part of it, the best part of it, I think, was to have a desire to communicate with people in this way. The idea that there was a story or there were ideas that I really wanted to share, that I really wanted to see if I could get people fired up in the same way that I was about these strange corners of history that I kept finding myself in. And I'm increasingly kind of monkish and humble in my approaches to writing now. I view it much more as a kind of continuous process, that the publication is serving the writing rather than the writing serving the publication, which I feel is the correct way around to have it. You know, I hope that I keep getting published, that I keep getting books out, because it will allow me to continue writing. I don't continue writing to keep publishing books in that sense, if that makes in that way. For me, it's something that is fulfilling, creative, it's meditative. It's a way for me to learn about myself, to learn about other people, to try and communicate with other people. Just the sheer thrill and fun of and challenge of trying to tell stories and solve problems with narrative is increasingly what I'm sort of obsessed with, or what writing gives to me. Remember, you know, so I talked about like that, and this is something that David Morley said, he put it so beautifully in A Warwick Thursdays a good number of years ago, that to think about making it as in the actual act of making the writing rather than making it as in succeeding, because like I was saying, it's tenuous. You know, in some ways I've made it. You know, I feel like this year I've made it more than I usually have in that way. I could unmake it just as quickly, you know. Does Head of Zeus go bust next year? Do the next books that I've got out tank completely, and people decide that they've actually had enough of taking a punt on a mid-lister like me, who gets some nice reviews and gets some okay sales, but isn't really kind of having the breakthroughs in that kind of way. Maybe, you know, that might well certainly happen. But I think, I hope that I'll continue to be committed to the act of writing, the kind of act of creation, that kind of way. So a lot of questions I ask to people is, you've got to think about what you want out of publication in that sort of way. What is your, what need do you hope that it will fulfill in your life in that sense? It's not a given, it's not a thing that you have to do. It's a thing that it has some specific hoops to kind of jump through in that kind of way. It is not a solution to all of your problems. It will not necessarily make you feel whole and complete in the way that you perhaps would like it to in that sort of sense. But if it works for you, if it suits you, if it suits your writing and the kind of writing that you're doing as well, it's offered huge amounts to me in terms of, like, I'm tremendously, tremendously grateful to have the books out, to have written the books that I have, and to have the books as they are. Even, you know, they've been great successes to me. They've not been great successes in a, you know, bestseller publishing sense in that kind of way. But they meant something. They meant a lot to me, and they've meant something to a few other people as well in terms of readership and that kind of thing. And yeah, so that's my rough journey. That's the kind of, like, the sense of, like, that's how I got here, which is, again, not on you. I think most writers that you speak to on Warwick 30s will probably tell you some kind of version of this. Lots of trialing out. Some projects they try, some of them fail. They have some successes, they have some setbacks, they endure rejection kind of along the way. I've endured probably less rejection, certainly at an agent level, than a lot of writers in that sense. Like, I submitted to 2 agents, you know, but like I said, I got the full gamut. One of them just knocked it back off 3 chapters. The other one went on and ran with it and is my agent to this day. But I think a lot of that was back to what I was saying at the start, which was around having a... I've got a few skills as a writer. One of them, I think, is that ability to view my work with fairly objective eyes as a reader would, in that sort of sense. That's something I deliberately kind of cultivated. It's kind of undersung. It's very easy to get focused on the beautiful sentences and the intricate character work and that kind of thing, which all helps and all matters. But my secret weapons, compared to, like, some of the other people that I've studied with who haven't broken through in the same way that I have yet, have mostly been based around persistence, and mostly been based around that ability to view my own work and then apply the persistence to keep working on it in that kind of way, I would say. But in terms of finding, actually, I'll tell you what, I'll take are there questions on that. This is the brief Tim potted biography of the books. Anyone want to stick a hand up? Oh yeah, marvelous. Go for it, Nina.
Okay, sorry about that. I was just trying to figure out how to get the microphone on. But I know you touched on how you first wrote that one manuscript going into the MA, put it in a drawer, and then started working on Last King of Lydia. And then, so what was the time frame from you graduating from Warwick with the MA and then the first book being published?
Yeah, good. Ooh, in fact, let me just grab the book off my shelf. I'm trying to remember exactly. I can give you the date once I scratch out. I think it was... So I graduated, I was 2009, 2010 was my study year. So I graduated in 2010. My book, I believe, yes, 2013. It was spring 2013. So the process of that was that I graduated obviously in October 2010. Then spent that extra time, 3 months or so doing the editing process, showed it to the agent. Then she would have been showing it around, it must have been 2012, I think, when she was, so I was approaching her in, like, 2011, we were editing together, then in 2012, yeah, that's it, it was the 2012 London Book Fair was when it sold, and so then it's usually traditional publishing, about a year's run-up for publisher takes it on, then delivers it. It often, sometimes it depends on windows, in that sort of sense, like, I think, usually... new writers or debut writers or unknown writers are usually spring or summer That's the window, because you know, autumn is when, as I know Patrick is a survivor of Super Thursday, the worst words that you know as a bookseller. You know, that's when in autumn is when all your big Christmas hardbacks come out. That's all your celebrity biographies, all the big new hardback fiction and that kind of thing. It's a Christmas present, essentially. Debut writers, you're often selling them more. People tend to buy us less as gifts because we're unknown in that sort of sense. People tend to buy us more for themselves, so we're more Easter or summer holiday reading. You know, that's where they're kind of pitching in that sense. But it's usually going to be like a year's run-up in a traditional publishing setup, depending on these kind of publishing timing windows, depending on kind of how it goes.
Great, thanks.
No worries. Yeah, go for it, Veronica. Oh, I can't hear you. I see your microphone's on. Are you there, Veronica? I can't hear you, I'm afraid. Can anyone hear Veronica, or is she silent? You could try typing a question in the chat if you would like, see if you can speak. Like going once, going twice. Well, see if you can wrangle your go Carlotta.
So you send chapters out to the agent, right, and all of that. How long before they respond? And do agents ever not respond after you've sent out the whole manuscript? Is that something they ever do?
I'd say that agents usually try to respond to everything they get. I think it's pretty weird if they don't respond to a full. You know, that sometimes stuff will like slip kind of beneath the slip through or for whatever reason in that kind of sense. I think it's pretty bad courtesy to not respond once they've sent a full in. I think I hear a Veronica in the back. I'll be with you in a second, Veronica.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the timing windows varies a lot. It depends on how busy the agent is and this kind of thing. I think they usually try and get back with full requests quite quickly on the whole. You know, it might be a process of several months, you know, to get back the three chapters. My memory of it has been distant times, I think. My memory of it is that it was maybe a month or two to hear back in the first instance, that the full manuscript request, my agent did get back to me pretty quickly, is my recollection. So that's there's no hard and fast rules. I think I'd say give it a few months and then give them a poke. You know, I think it's fine to sort of say, oh, I'm just checking, you know, that you received my submission, you know, and this kind of, and we'll get onto more of the practicalities around that in the second half of the talk, which I'll launch onto probably after Veronica. Yeah, go Veronica.
Yes, sorry, there's something wrong with my phone that wasn't working. I just wanted to ask a question. As an historical writer, how much research do you do, or can you do, considering, you know, the time, the era that you're writing about? And how comfortable do you feel about filling in the blanks when you can't use historical fact, inverted commas?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll be talking a bit more about this in the thrilling research to writing sessions that we're having later in the term. But also, I'll talk about it now as well in the... I mean, I'm a very comfortable blagger, is what I would say, frankly, in that sense. But part of that is due to the fact that I'm dealing with unreliable source texts by choice and sketchy sort of like parts of history. That's been my particular kind of niche. You know, Herodotus is my source text for the first couple of books, then the Icelandic sagas. Now I'm doing some stuff with, you know, very patchy bits of Roman history / Arthurian myth in that sense. There's loads and loads of gaps that we don't know about in that sense. I try and do a lot of research. I'm very comfortable inventing or imagining in the specific kind of context of the worlds that I'm kind of operating in a way. I try and find particular texts to anchor myself to, these kind of source texts, in terms of that I say, if in doubt, Herodotus is right, was my approach for the first couple of books, even when history says that Herodotus was almost certainly lying completely and making stuff on the spot. But I was happy to be playing in that world. Equally, when I was writing in the Icelandic sagas, you know, there's lots of the Icelandic sagas that are considered historically accurate, but there's lots of like some not even fantastic, but there's tropes and conventions of it that seem more like storytelling tropes than historical fact. I was really happy to kind of lean into those. I wanted to write in that world, in that kind of way, which for me was a way around. I mean, one great quote that I've heard is that the history police is not an organized force, you know, which I think is broadly kind of true in that sort of sense. I think the story is, you want to try and avoid anachronisms that, you know, are really distracting, or that kind of, I try to avoid breaking history over my knee, so to speak. But I think in terms of compressing times, yes, absolutely. In terms of inventing to fill in gaps, yes, absolutely. You know, I'm personally very kind of comfortable with it because I feel I'm playing within an unreliable world already. And my main focus, I suppose, is on telling a really good story, springboarding off some sketchy history to tell a what to me is an interesting story, rather than trying to attempt a recreation, you know, a sort of strict recreation, that sort of sense. But, you know, other writers kind of may vary. Oh, yeah, go for it. So Bella, and then I'll move
thank
on.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, hello. How often do you use illustrations to help you sort of picture out your characters and your settings, your story?
No worries. Not at all, actually. It's funny. I'm a really non-visual writer and reader, in fact. Interesting fact, you know, that some people may not know about. There's divisions between people who have an interior monologue, you know, who have a voice in their head, as in some of you may be voice people. I don't have a voice in my head unless I specifically conjure it. Equally with reading, some people are visual readers and like recreate the scene in their head. Some people don't. Someone was asking about this. I have a very hard time saying what happens in my head when I'm reading a book, but I'm relatively rarely fully visualizing the scene unless I'm really having trouble figuring out the logistics of what's going on within the scene. For me, it's a lot more about sensation, texture, emotion is kind of like what I, the rhythm and the cadence of the words. So I'm very non-visual in that kind of respect. Some writers are super into it in that kind of way, obviously, you know, and will be very kind of visually based, both in their kind of sourcing and that kind of thing. But I'm not, it's just not how my brain works as a writer or as a kind of reader. But there'll be time for some more questions at the end. I'm just going to do a quick whistle stop tour through some advice, you know, because that was my journey, was the first part, but some more general advice for approaching agents in the traditional publishing model, which I should say there are others as well. The traditional publishing, so in the UK, generally speaking, with some exceptions, if you want to be published by a medium or large size publisher, you usually need an agent. Most publishers don't take, most large and medium publishers don't take what are called unsolicited submissions. On the whole, small presses do a lot of the time, and there's some very good small presses out there, people like Gallivega Press and other stories and this kind of thing, often very, very small scale, you know, run by a number that you could fit all of them in one car or a minivan in that sort of sense. They do really good work. They punch well above their weight a lot of the time, and they often take on some of the more unusual or commercially less obviously viable kind of work in that kind of way. So some of your publishing approaches to publication are to think around, what is the stuff that I'm writing? What avenue might be best for it in that kind of way? The small press is really, really good for championing more niche experimental work a lot of the time. The kind of stuff that I was writing, I felt I probably had a chance at more traditional publishers. So I went through the agent traditional medium large size publisher kind of pathway in that sense. It was mostly based around my perception of the work that basically there was a fairly straightforward storytelling style, and I thought a story with frankly a lot of drama was the stuff that I've kind of found in that sort of sense. You know, lots and lots of stuff happening in quite dramatic ways which you could sell to a lot of people potentially in that kind of way, informed my kind of decision to go there. So do think about what path might be kind of best for you in that kind of respect, based on the kind of work that you're doing. In terms of finding an agent, the Artists and Writers Yearbook is a useful resource to kind of get started on. It's a big directory that's published every year. You can usually find, it doesn't really matter if the directory is like a year out of date, you can usually find secondhand copies. Or libraries usually have a copy lying around. It may not be the most up-to-date one, but that's usually fine. Has directories of agencies in it. You know, you want to start to figure, you know, going to obviously to Warwick Thursday's events is good too. Getting on Twitter, you know, sort of like various agents are on Twitter, getting on Book Twitter and kind of trying to find people on there is also kind of good in that sense, just to try and get a sense of who's out there. So obviously a lot of it, you're trying to be specific in who you're pitching the book to in that kind of way. Do both read the submission guidelines for agencies carefully and for what individual agents are after carefully. They are often very genre specific in terms of what they are and are not interested in. So you don't want to just spam out, you know, submissions to, you know, 100 agents, you know, irregardless of where they work or what they're kind of interested in that kind of way. I think you do want to be more targeted in that way. So it's worth seeing what they're interested in, what other kind of clients they represent. I mean, people sometimes ask around, how do you tell if an agent is legitimate or not? A quick way is look at their client list or look at the client list of the agency that they work for. Investigate, are they actual authors? They don't need to be authors you've necessarily heard of, but, you know, sort of are they actual published authors in this kind of way? The other rule of thumb is important to be aware of with how agents work is that the agent gets paid when you get paid. The money flows from the publisher to the writer via the agent is how it works. You should be very skeptical of anyone who is charging you a reading fee or anything like that. There may be exceptions out there. Mostly for agents, I believe that is the sign. That is a bad sign. That is the sign of possibly being a scam of some kind in that sense. The agent gets a cut of your paycheck, usually somewhere between 15 and 20%, depending on what is being sold in that kind of way. The agent has every incentive. The agent's incentives and your financial incentives are directly aligned. The reason that I'm a fan of my agent or of agents more generally is partly because of the really amazing editorial guidance that you will receive from them, the way they understand story from that more commercial, broader point of view is incredibly useful. They are also your champion in practical financial terms. Publishers are lovely people, broadly lovely industry. However, the publisher's financial incentive is to get your work as cheaply as they possibly can. That's just business, you know, sort of in that kind of way. That's not to say they are out to cheat you, but they just have the incentive to pay as little as they could possibly pay to secure the rights to your work. An agent's financial incentives are directly aligned with yours. The more you get paid, the more they get paid. So they are your champion. They are haggling on your behalf. They generally pay for themselves, even assuming you could secure a deal in the first place without an agent, which is sometimes unlikely. They often will pay for themselves simply through negotiation. You know, this is what happened in my most recent deal, was that my agent haggled up. Her percentage was entirely paid for by the amount that she haggled up in that sort of sense. So otherwise it would have been cut from the original kind of figure that they offered in that way. So that's things to be aware of in terms of dealing, in terms of how you approach agents. Let me see if I can share my quick. So yeah, so when you're approaching an agent for fiction, this is fiction specifically, you will usually, you know, read the submission guidelines carefully, try and find agents who you think might be good fits for your work. This can be slightly more indirect, though. I mean, one interesting thing about my agent is that when she came to Warwick Thursdays, she expressed an interest in historical fiction, what caught Maureen's ear. She said, oh, yeah, and she was supervising my long project. It was like, oh, Tim's working on historical fiction. Maybe this would be a good fit. Funnily enough, what my agent meant, you know, when she said historical fiction, was like 1950s, you know, sort of like her first like big hit, her first book, in fact, I think, her first client was Sadie Jones's The Outcast, which won like a gazillion prizes and sold a million copies or whatever. So it was a really big landing for her. So she liked like early 20th century stuff and that kind of thing. 6th century BC was definitely not her jam or what she would think of in that kind of way. But I've ended up an interesting client for her. Because the way that she put it when we sat down for the first meeting was that she was like, I'm going to get to talk to loads of editors that I've never got to speak to before. Like, and that's all that she knew, but she never had anything to kind of pitch at them because I was slightly unusual to them. But the description that she has on her website is, I represent literary fiction, well-written commercial fiction, including crime and thrillers. I'm actively looking for original, compelling debuts. I love books that transport me to a different time or place, books that have a secret or mystery at the heart of them, books about family and relationships, books that are psychologically complex and emotionally involving, always beautifully written and with a distinctive voice. And that blurb was what I aspired towards. You know, when I read that blurb, oh yeah, that's the kind of stuff I would hope that I'm writing, or that I'm trying to write in that sense. So even though I wasn't a fit in terms of her list already in that kind of way, because I was writing, or my interest in writing aligned with hers in that kind of sense, we've ended up being a kind of good team. So you don't have to be, it doesn't have to be as reductive as being like, oh, this agent represents exactly the kind of work that I do. Sometimes if you see their blurb, as long as you're not going outside certain genres that they're not interested in that kind of way, it's worth looking at the verb that they have about the kind of work that they're interested in, and think about if that chimes with how you perceive your own work in that sort of way. So I sent my, I'll see if I can share my query letter. Share content. Share file, share application screen. Sorry, I'm not too much of a Blackboard wizard, but I think, so I'm getting my entire screen here, but I think I can hopefully show you something. Well, I think actually I won't do this, but with me. I might share as a file. I can send around, basically I'll send around for anyone who wants to email me, and I'll send you my query letter if you like. I've got a version of my query letter with some annotations of my own on it in that kind of way. Mostly the things I'd say with a query letter is around, you can find various guides to writing them online as well. There is a vaguely kind of accepted formula to them. Mostly it's around initially positioning the book, sort of saying just what is it, what's the length of the final manuscript, and then you're trying to do a kind of blurb. You know, you're trying to pitch the book in a paragraph or two. Sometimes two paragraph structures are what are used, where the what's really compelling and exciting about the book, and you can drop major plot spoilers if you want to. I did in mine. They don't care about spoilers in that sense, but what's the really enticing, compelling pitch that you can kind of put to them? You also want to put a bit in there about why you're approaching them specifically, what it's about them as an agent or their agency that makes you think they would be a good fit for the work. And a very brief biography of anything that's relevant. You know, I mean, I just said I'd done an MA. Mine was basically, I've just done an MA and I've not had anything published, you know, because I was just being frank when I hadn't. I had a few, like, I had the anthology and that kind of thing, but I didn't have any kind of professional credits or anything like that. But the only relevant biography that I had, I thought, was that I'd recently finished the MA in writing at Warwick, as a sign that I was taking the writing seriously to some degree, and that I'd had some, like, professional eyes on the work in that kind of way. You know, anyone who wants, you do email me in and I'll pitch you around. It had a truly terrible original title as well. But my secret weapon was that I alluded the fact that I thought the title might be terrible too, which my secret weapon to try and indicate that I might be quite good to work with. The other thing to bear in mind with fiction specifically is you need the whole book ready to go before you pitch it, by and large, in that kind of way. And it needs to be ready to go. This is often, you know, if they ask for a full manuscript request, it's because they want it very soon. And again, this is what I think Carlotta was asking about. This is usually why they'll get quite quick responses based on a full, because a lot of the time, the reason they want to see the work is it's based around certain particular timing windows, you know, because they're thinking, I'm going to the London Book Fair in 3 weeks, Rafe is going to be there, and I know he's looking for a new debut in sci-fi. This new sci-fi book could be the thing. Does this mean we can't start approaching agents now, asked Kathy. I would say not in an official capacity, not in the sense of sending queries out on the whole for fiction. Non-fiction actually often works differently. Non-fiction, they do often accept a proposal for a book and sample chapters. Fiction specifically, they usually want you to have finished the entire thing, ready to go, before you send on your kind of initial query in that kind of way. Because lots of books sound, particularly in fiction, lots of books sound theoretically exciting and then fall apart after the first three chapters in that kind of sense. So they want the main thing to be there to work with. And again, it may involve certain specific timing windows for when and how they want to pitch your book kind of onwards. So make sure it is in good shape, make sure it's ready to go. Before you send on the thing, send them out in batches as well. I mean, obviously I did two, and obviously my plan was to send more. There was the two agents that I had some kind of initial connection with, and then I thought if that doesn't work out, then I'll start going through and compiling spreadsheet lists and sending them out. Do send them out in batches, because that allows you to be receptive to feedback that you get. You will get, hopefully, sometimes it will just be form rejections, that's fine. Sometimes you will get personalized feedback, a little bit of personalized feedback as well. And if you get some consistent notes that the pacing feels off in the first three chapters, or it wasn't quite kind of compelling enough or whatever else, that will give you something to work on and redraft before you sort of send it out to the next batch of agents and kind of try again in that sort of way. So do that process of continuous thinking and learning. The thing to be aware of, this is something I emphasize in my teaching, is that you've got very little time to grab an agent. They will put it down after a paragraph if it's not for them, in that kind of way. The book does not have time to get good or get exciting in five chapters or three chapters, or even by the end of kind of chapter one. They read that way because editors read that way. And again, this is one of the brute force commercial aspects that you may or may not wish to engage with as a writer. But agents read that way because editors read that way because readers read that way, especially when they're reading nobodies like Tim Leach. You know, just to get them to pick my book up off the shelf is enough of a struggle. To get them to open it and consider buying me when Tolstoy and Virginia Woolf are floating out there for you to read, that's real tough. So I've got to get them. You've got to get them early in that sort of sense. So do really think about. Kathy, hopefully we'll be having an agent in next term. I think we'll be doing mostly Warwick staff here for this term, but then for next term I'm hoping to get some agents in. So they do want something that is very gripping early on in that kind of way. And there doesn't have to be things exploding. There doesn't have to be, you know, sort of it just has to be something that's gripping and compelling in some sort of way that makes you want to read on. So it's really worth paying attention to your first three chapters and really thinking these should be as unputdownable as they possibly can be in this kind of way. Then they will ask the full manuscript. You should have ready to go to them. They will give the full. Then you'll have a meeting with them. And it's important to bear in mind with the meeting that you have with them is that the key thing is that it's not a job interview. It's not, they are not interviewing you. You are not interviewing them. You're going into business together potentially, and you're trying to figure out if it's a good fit. So relax a little bit, you know, sort of like the big thing I say to people, getting full manuscript requests is really good because it means that the first three chapters that you've written looks like something professional. That's what that means. If the full manuscript gets rejected, that then tells you that your opening is looking really good, but you've dropped the baton at some point along the way. So you know you've got things to pay attention to in terms of structure or pacing or character development or whatever else it is plotting within the story. But just getting a full manuscript request is a really strong vote of confidence in those first three chapters and in your writing kind of more generally. So do be very happy and very proud if you do get a full manuscript request, even if it doesn't then proceed further at that point. It's a sign that you're onto something potentially. Don't feel that you have to go. If you get if you get a meeting based off the full manuscript, it is something you should be willing to walk away from potentially if it doesn't feel right to you. If you are able to get into the room with an agent, it is unlikely that is the only agent you will ever be able to get into a room with. You know, that doesn't mean you get to be an ass to them or like start throwing your toys around, you know, or be a diva at them in that kind of sense. It just means that if you're getting a full manuscript request from an agent and they want to meet with you, they think there's a good chance they can sell it. Not a certainty, but they think there's a pretty good chance that with the right editing, they'll be able to sell the book, which means that you are producing work, we have produced work that is of close to professional quality in that respect. They'll ask you in the meeting, they'll talk to you about edits, potential changes. Obviously, be open-minded to those. Don't, you know, like we always tell you with any critique, don't necessarily fall over yourself to say, yes, of course, I'll do. I mean, I said when the agent suggested, she was like, I think maybe it should be two books rather than one. I said, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. I'll I'll have a think about it. And I went away and had a thought about it. I wasn't immediately going, yes, absolutely, of course. Yes, Caroline, whatever you say, I'll do whatever you want. But I was open and receptive to the idea in that respect. And when I went away and thought about it, the key thing for me was that I felt that she was trying to make the book more of what it was. She wasn't trying to make it something else, you know, like I do write books with lots of death and drama in them, but primarily for me, they're books about characters and ideas and dialogue in that respect. So if she'd said, yeah, this is fine and all, but we just need more like more blood and shagging or whatever else, you know, I'd have been like, I don't think that's not the kind of book that I want to write, really, in that kind of way. All the edits that she gave seemed to be ones that were making the book more of what it was. Oh, yeah, Kathy. So like, generally speaking, on an agent's website, you usually have pretty strict and kind of clear submission guidelines in that sense. Usually with a query letter, it's three chapters. Sometimes they'll also ask for a synopsis. The synopsis is just a page document that is pretty dryly and boringly talking about the beats of the story. It doesn't need, you know, I know that Carlotta was wrestling with this earlier on in the summertime, you know, sort of like it makes your book sound horrible. They're deeply uninspiring to write and often to read, but they're main there to go for it, Carlotta.
I was just going to say that narrowing it down to one page is nearly impossible. I ended up sending out two pages because they wanted it double spaced as well. And it's so hard. You have to remove so much and it feels really horrible.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But it's worth doing that again because part of it is a kind of just to have that focus of that. It does force you to boil the book down to the major beats of the plot in that kind of way, which is primarily what they're kind of looking for in that sense. But each agent has sort of slightly different demands. How long is three chapters? How long is a piece of string? It's usually, they also will say, you know, no more than 50 pages double spaced, you know, sort of like that's generally like an extract that they're kind of looking for on the whole. If you've got particularly long or particularly kind of short chapters, you know, sort of thinking in those kind of 30, 50 pages, perhaps, double spaced. It's off the top of my head anyway. So when you sit down with them, it's about thinking about, they will ask you as well about your further ambitions, about what you might want to write next. So you might want to think about what answers you might have for them in that way. And primarily it's about, do you think they'll be good to work with? You know, is there someone that you like, that you connect with, that is saying interesting things about your writing, that you would like to be a kind of collaborator with, that you trust to be a kind of champion of your work? And so I would say just go with your gut in the agent world in that sort of sense. You know, do you trust your feelings in that kind of way to think about, this is someone who I think will be a really good champion for my work. This will be someone that will be a really good editorial collaborator to kind of work with in that sort of way. And if you're getting to the point of having a meeting with an agent, do be willing to walk away if you feel that it's just not quite right for you, if their vision for your career or for the book itself doesn't really chime with the direction that you want to go in. But obviously, yeah, be a Jedi, exactly. But obviously be open-minded too, you know, sort of like do be receptive to the edits that they see. Do be receptive to the knowledge that they have to kind of bring to the table in that kind of way. But that's my main advice on agents and agencies. Like I was saying, it's been something that's been tremendously kind of positive in my writing life. I do recommend it when you can find one that kind of is a good match for you in that kind of way. But most of it in questions, practical questions about some of this practical procedure, would you say? Any questions about what I've said in terms of agents, applying to agents, writing query letters, writing kind of books that agents are interested in? Are there any? Yeah, go for it, Nina.
My question is more so like, how to say it? It's a really exciting hypothetical. Say you hear back from, I don't know, say you send it out to 10 agents, you hear back from three that might want to work with you. Process goes along and you schedule three meetings with them. So it's like I guess my question more so is, even if all of them, as in like you really like their feedback, you could see yourself working with them, but how do you then turn them down after having reached out to them? You know, like, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what they'll ask about, they'll usually ask in the meeting, are you chatting to anyone else about this? You know, and so, I mean, the other thing I should say as well is that, like, I didn't sign a contract with my agent until I signed a book deal with the publisher, basically, because from her, you know, I asked to see a contract to make sure that I knew what I would be signing further down the line. I made a kind of gentleman's agreement with her that I wasn't going to shop it around anywhere else, you know, because I said, she was like, I really want to work with you on this. I'd like to work with you exclusively on this. You know, there's not a reason to sign. Some agents will sign a contract early. For her, from her point of view, she was like, for both of us, it's easier because you might want to walk away on a walk away. But let's, I would like to enter into kind of gentleman's agreement at that point. So usually in the meeting, you know, I think it would be worth, they'll often ask, it would be worth kind of telling them that you've got other meetings. If they were scheduled in that kind of way, if, you know, if you were like, by the time you'd had one meeting, you had another couple scheduled, I think you can be totally honest with them and say, you know, yeah, I've got another meeting. I've not got another couple of meetings with agents, you know, some of this kind of thing, you know, like, and then if, you know, and then if you pick one again, it's no harm, no foul. I think it would be bad to lead multiple, and, you know, you should not do this because they talk to each other. It's a very like talky industry in this kind of way. And if you start trying to run games on agents, they will all talk to each other and your name will be mud. So don't do that. You know, but I think if, as long as you are honest and straight up with them about what the stage is in that kind of way, and they will usually ask if they want to work with you on something, they will usually want to work with you exclusively. They will want either a, you know, a contractual commitment or a kind of, they may settle for a kind of gentleman or gentlewoman's kind of agreement in that sort of way. Then the so that would be the, that's what I would generally say. I don't think there will be hard feelings. I think there will be hard feelings if you'd lied to an agent and like got lots of edits of lots of them and that kind of thing, and like, you know, tried them like dating them without letting them know that you were dating them in that kind of way, and then like you're like, oh yeah, sorry, thanks for all those edits that you spent 6 months doing with no, for no money for you, but I've decided to go with your rival in that sort of sense. But I think that just have honest kind of conversations with them in that kind of respect. Kathy, about agents for, I think, I think it's usually your country of residence is where you're usually looking for your agent. You know, that's which, you know, if you, you know, if you're in the UK, I'd imagine you'd probably pitch to kind of UK agents. That's actually a question. I don't know about the specifics of, you will often need different publishers. It's a question of like multiple agents or not in that kind of way. That's a kind of like technical question. I don't actually like have a particular hard and fast answer to, I have to confess. You might have to look elsewhere. Yasmin, go ahead.
Hi, I was just wondering, you mentioned earlier about sending out query letters in batches. Is there like a certain number of agents that you would say you should apply to in like one go? Because I was thinking if you apply to like 10 or something in one go, I mean, that could maybe be like leading them on as well in a way. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they'll be expecting simultaneous submissions, you know, so that they're in like, they will be expecting you to send it on to multiple people in that kind of sense. And part of it is that, part of it is their incentive to get back to you in that sort of sense, you know, because like the, I believe Carter was kind of talking about earlier on, because they know that when someone is querying agents, they're probably querying multiple agents, and that's part of their incentive, is to get through the kind of slush pile, because otherwise they may well miss you in that sense, because you might have got snapped up by someone else. But I think I don't think there's a kind of hard and fast rule. I'd maybe recommend about 5, seems like a decent number to me. You know, send to 5 agents, see what comes back, you know, wait until you've heard back, or given a reasonable like length of time, given a couple of months or 2 or 3 months for the agents to kind of get back to you. If you've heard, you know, then maybe send out another batch after that, you know, after you've done some revisions on the feedback in that kind of way. But I think by and large, most agents will be expecting you to do simultaneous submissions. You know, that that's kind of just part of the course in that kind of way. I think it's only once you're at the stage of like having meetings with them where, you know, it might be start to become ethically dubious if the agents don't know that there's other agents in your life in that kind of way, if that makes sense. But yeah, any other nuts and bolts questions that people have, agents from an author's point of view? So going once, going twice. But thank you so much. You know, again, like anyone wants to talk about this further as well, obviously office hours are always open. reminds me of when my sister felt she was cheating on her estate agent by having a second one. I mean, I don't think you have to feel too badly about cheating on estate agents, you know, sort of like they're, you know, like less reputable businesses than agents, I would usually say, on the whole, in my experience at least. But at any point anyone wants to, and again, like, I'll often do this to, if you want me to take a look at, if you get to the point of kind of querying stuff and you want me to kind of cast eyes over a query letter, do feel free to like drop me a line. If you ever have any doubts about, you know, I had a couple of them over the summer, like people like had some approaches for agents. They wanted like some translation of agentees or publisheries in that sense. Absolutely. Or you just want to kind of talk about projects in an office hour, obviously kind of hit me up. And like I said, the screen sharing seemed to work in strange, terrifying, infinite ways when I tried to do it. But if you do want to see my original query letter, which is not a perfect query letter, but it's not bad, do let me know. But otherwise, thanks so much for coming. Really lovely to see everyone. You know, any further questions that crop up, do drop me an email. And hope you enjoy the rest of the Warwick Thursdays for the rest of term. But yeah, take care of yourselves. I will cease recording.